honestly, if you will. I do not rob men who were tied and gagged. I do not demand that my victims help me. I do not tell them that I am acting for their own good. I stake my life in every encounter with men, and they have a chance to match their guns and their brains against mine in fair battle. Fair? It's I, against the organized strength, the guns, the planes, the battleships, of 5 continents. If it's a moral judgment that you wish to pronounce, Mr. Reardon, then who is the man of higher morality? I or Wesley Mooch? I have no answer to give you, said Reardon, his voice low. Why should you be shocked, Mr. Reardon? I am merely complying with the system which my fellow men have established. If they believe that force is the proper means to deal with one another, I am giving them what they ask for. If they believe that the purpose of my life is to serve them, let them try to enforce their creed. If they believe that my mind is their property, let them come and get it. But what sort of life have you chosen? To what purpose are you giving your mind? To the cause of my love. Which is what? Justice. Served by being a pirate? By working for the day when I won't have to be a pirate any longer. Which day is that? The day when you'll be free to make a profit on Reardon metal. Oh, God, said Reardon, laughing, his voice desperate. Is that your ambition? Donnershold's face did not change. It is. Do you expect to live to see that day? Yes. Don't you? No. Then what are you looking forward to, Mr. Reardon? Nothing. What are you working for? Reardon glanced at him. Why do you ask that? To make you understand why I'm not. Don't expect me ever to approve of a criminal. I don't expect it. But there are a few things I want to help you to see. Even if they're true, the things you said, why did you choose to be a bandit? Why didn't you simply step out like... He stopped. Like Ellis Wyatt, Mr. Reardon? Like Andrew Stockton? Like your friend Ken Daneker? Yes. Would you approve of that? I... He stopped, shocked by his own words. The shock that came next was to see Donnershold smile. It was like seeing the first green of spring on the sculptured plains of an iceberg. Reardon realized suddenly, for the first time, that Donnershold's face was more than handsome, that it had the startling beauty of physical perfection, the hard, proud features, the scornful mouth of a Viking statue. Yet he had not been aware of it, almost as if the dead sternness of the face had forbidden the impertinence of an appraisal, but the smile was brilliantly alive. I do approve of it, Mr. Reardon, but I've chosen a special mission of my own. I'm after a man whom I want to destroy. He died many centuries ago, but until the last trace of him is wiped out of men's minds, we will not have a decent world to live in. What man? Robin Hood? Reardon looked at him blankly, not understanding. He was the man who robbed the rich and gave to the poor. Well, I'm the man who robs the poor and gives to the rich. Or, to be exact, the man who robs the thieving poor and gives back to the productive rich. What in blazes do you mean? If you remember the stories you've read about me in the newspapers before they stopped printing them, you know that I've never robbed a private ship and never taken any private property, nor have I ever robbed a military vessel, because the purpose of a military fleet is to protect from violence the citizens who paid for it, which is the proper function of a government. But I have seized every loot carrier that came within range of my guns, every government relief ship, subsidy ship, loan ship, gift ship, every vessel with the cargo of goods taken by force from some men for the unpaid, unearned benefit of others. I seized the boats that sailed under the flag of the idea which I am fighting, the idea that need is a sacred idol requiring human sacrifices, that the need of some men is the knife of a guillotine hanging over others, that all of us must live with our work, our hopes, our plans, our efforts, at the mercy of the moment when that knife will descend upon us, and that the extent of our ability is the extent of our danger, so that success will bring our heads down on the block, while failure will give us the right to pull the cord. This is the horror which Robin Hood immortalized as an ideal of righteousness. It is said that he fought against the looting rulers and returned the loot to those who had been robbed. But that is not the meaning of the legend which has survived. He is remembered not as a champion of property, but as a champion of need. Not as a defender of the robbed, but as a provider of the poor. He is held to be the first man who assumed a halo of virtue by practicing charity with wealth which he did not own, by giving away goods which he had not produced, by making others pay for the luxury of his pity. He is the man who became the symbol of the idea that need, not achievement, is the source of rights, that we don't have to produce, only to want, that the earned does not belong to us, but the unearned does. He became a justification for every mediocrity who, unable to make his own living, has demanded the power to dispose of the property of his betters by proclaiming his willingness to devote his life to his inferiors at the price of robbing his superiors. It is this foulest of creatures, the double parasite who lives on the sores of the poor and the blood of the rich, whom men have come to regard as a moral ideal, and this has brought us to a world where the more a man produces, the closer he becomes to the loss of all his rights, until, if his ability is great enough, he becomes a rightless creature delivered as prey to any claimant, while, in order to be placed above rights, above principles, above morality, placed where anything is permitted to him, even plunder and murder, all a man has to do is to be in need. Do you wonder why the world is collapsing around us? That is what I'm fighting, Mr. Reardon. Until men learn that of all human symbols, Robin Hood is the most immoral and the most contemptible, there will be no justice on earth and no way for mankind to survive. Reardon listened, feeling numb. But under the numbness, like the first thrust of a seed breaking through, he felt an emotion he could not identify, except that it seemed familiar and very distant, like something experienced and renounced long ago. What I actually am, Mr. Reardon, is a policeman. It is a policeman's duty to protect men from criminals, criminals being those who seize wealth by force. It is a policeman's duty to retrieve stolen property and return it to its owners. But when robbery becomes the purpose of the law, and the policeman's duty becomes not the protection but the plunder of property, then it is an outlaw who has to become a policeman. I have been selling the cargoes I retrieve to some special customers of mine in this country, who pay me in gold. Also, I have been selling my cargoes to the smugglers and the black market traders of the people states of Europe. Do you know the conditions that exist in those people states? Since production and trade, not violence, were decreed to be crimes, the best men of Europe had no choice but to become criminals. The slave drivers of those states are kept in power by the handouts from their fellow looters in countries not yet fully drained, such as this country. I do not let the handouts reach them. I sell the goods to Europe's lawbreakers at the highest prices I can get, and I make them pay me in gold. Gold is the objective value, the means of preserving one's wealth and one's future. Nobody is permitted to have gold in Europe, except the whip-wielding friends of humanity who claim that they spend it for the welfare of their victims. That is the gold which my smuggler customers obtain to pay me. How? By the same method I use to obtain the goods. And then I return the gold to those from whom the goods were stolen. To you, Mr. Reardon, and to other men like you. Reardon grasped the nature of the emotion he had forgotten. It was the emotion he had felt when, at the age of 14, he had looked at his first paycheck, when, at the age of 24, he had been made superintendent of the ore mines, when, as the owner of the mines, he had placed in his own name his first order for new equipment from the best concern of the time, 20th Century Motors. An emotion of solemn, joyous excitement. The sense of winning his place in a world he respected and earning the recognition of men he admired. For almost 2 decades, that emotion had been buried under a mount of wreckage, as the years had added layer upon gray layer of contempt, of indignation, of his struggle not to look around him, not to see those he dealt with, not to expect anything from men, and to keep as a private vision within the four walls of his office the sense of that world into which he had hoped to rise. Yet there it was again, breaking through from under the wreckage, that feeling of quickened interest, of listening to the luminous voice of reason, with which one could communicate and deal and live. But it was the voice of a pirate, speaking about acts of violence, offering him this substitute for his world of reason and justice. He could not accept it. He could not lose whatever remnant of his vision he still retained. He listened, wishing he could escape, yet knowing that he would not miss a word of it. "I deposit the gold in a bank, in a gold standard bank, Mr. Reardon, to the account of men who are its rightful owners. They are the men of superlative ability who made their fortunes by personal effort in free trade, using no compulsion, no help from the government. They are the great victims who have contributed the most and suffered the worst injustice in return. Their names are written in my book of restitution. Every load of gold which I bring back is divided among them and deposited to their accounts." "Who are they?" "You are one of them, Mr. Reardon. I cannot compute all the money that has been extorted from you in hidden taxes, in regulations, in wasted time, in lost effort, in energy spent to overcome artificial obstacles. I cannot compute the sum. But if you wish to see its magnitude, look around you. The extent of the misery now spreading through this once prosperous country is the extent of the injustice which you have suffered. If men refuse to pay the debt they owe you, this is the manner in which they will pay for it. But there is one part of the debt which is computed and on record. That is the part which I have made it my purpose to collect and return to you."
"What is that?"
"Your income tax, Mr. Reardon."
"What?"
"Your income tax for the last 12 years.
You intend to refund that?"
"In full and in gold, Mr. Reardon." Reardon burst out laughing. He laughed like a young boy, in simple amusement, in enjoyment of the incredible.
"Good God, you're a policeman, and a collector of internal revenue, too?"
"Yes," said Donnishold gravely.
"You're not serious about this, are you?"
"Do I look as if I'm joking?"
"But this is preposterous."
"Any more preposterous than Directive 10-289. It's not real or possible. Is only evil real and possible?"
"But
are you thinking that death and taxes are our only certainty, Mr. Reardon? Well, there's nothing I can do about the first. But if I lift the burden of the second, men might learn to see the connection between the two, and what a longer, happier life they have the power to achieve. They might learn to hold, not death and taxes, but life and production as their two absolutes, and as the base of their moral code."
Reardon looked at him, not smiling. The tall, slim figure with the windbreaker stressing its trained, muscular agility was that of a highwayman. The stern marble face was that of a judge. The dry, clear voice was that of an efficient bookkeeper.
"The looters are not the only ones who have kept records on you, Mr. Reardon. So have I. I have in my files copies of all your income tax returns for the last 12 years, as well as the returns of all my other clients. I have friends in some astonishing places who obtain the copies I need. I divide the money among my clients in proportion to the sums extorted from them. Most of my accounts have now been paid to their owners. Yours is the largest one left to settle. On the day when you will be ready to claim it, the day when I'll know that no penny of it will go back to support the looters, I will turn your account over to you. Until then..." He glanced down at the gold on the ground. "Pick it up, Mr. Reardon. It's not stolen. It's yours."
Reardon would not move, or answer, or look down.
"Much more than that lies in the bank in your name."
"What bank?"
"Do you remember Midas Mulligan of Chicago?"
"Yes, of course."
"All my accounts are deposited at the Mulligan Bank."
"There is no Mulligan Bank in Chicago."
"It is not in Chicago."
Reardon let a moment pass. "Where is it?"
"I think that you will know it before long, Mr. Reardon, but I cannot tell you now." He added,
"I must tell you, however, that I am the only one responsible for this undertaking. It is my own personal mission. No one is involved in it but me and the men of my ship's crew. Even my banker has no part in it, except for keeping the money I deposit. Many of my friends do not approve of the course I've chosen, but we all choose different ways to fight the same battle. And this is mine. Reardon smiled contemptuously. "Aren't you one of those damn altruists who spends his time on a non-profit venture and risks his life merely to serve others?"
"No, Mr. Reardon. I am investing my time in my own future. When we are free and have to start rebuilding from out of the ruins, I want to see the world reborn as fast as possible. If there is then some working capital in the right hands, in the hands of our best, our most productive men, it will save years for the rest of us, and incidentally centuries for the history of the country. Did you ask what you meant to me? Everything I admire, everything I want to be on the day when the earth will have a place for such state of being, everything I want to deal with, even if this is the only way I can deal with you and be of use to you at present."
"Why?" whispered Reardon.
"Because, my only love, the only value I care to live for, is that which has never been loved by the world, has never won recognition or friends or defenders. Human ability. That is the love I am serving. And if I should lose my life, to what better purpose could I give it?"
The man who had lost the capacity to feel, thought Reardon, and knew that the austerity of the marble face was the form of a disciplined capacity to feel too deeply. The even voice was continuing dispassionately,
"I wanted you to know this. I wanted you to know it now, when it must seem to you that you're abandoned at the bottom of a pit among subhuman creatures who are all that's left of mankind. I wanted you to know in your most hopeless hour that the day of deliverance is much closer than you think. And there was one special reason why I had to speak to you and tell you my secret ahead of the proper time. Have you heard of what happened to Orrin Boyle's steel mills on the coast of Maine?"
"Yes," said Reardon, and was shocked to hear that the word came as a gasp out of the sudden jolt of eagerness within him. "I didn't know whether it was true."
"It's true, I did it. Mr. Boyle is not going to manufacture Reardon metal on the coast of Maine. He is not going to manufacture it anywhere. Neither is any other looting louse who thinks that a directive can give him a right to your brain. Whoever attempts to produce that metal will find his furnaces blown up, his machinery blasted, his shipments wrecked, his plant set on fire. So many things will happen to any man who tries it that people will say there's a curse on it, and there will soon be no worker in the country willing to enter the plant of any new producer of Reardon metal. If men like Boyle think that force is all they need to rob their betters, let them see what happens when one of their betters chooses to resort to force. I wanted you to know, Mr. Reardon, that none of them will produce your metal, nor make a penny on it."
Because he felt an exultant desire to laugh, as he had laughed at the news of Wyatt's fire, as he had laughed at the crash of Dunconia Copper, and knew that if he did, the thing he feared would hold him, would not release him this time, and he would never see his mills again, Reardon drew back, and for a moment kept his lips closed tight to utter no sound. When the moment was over, he said quietly, his voice firm and dead, "Take that gold of yours and get away from here. I won't accept the help of a criminal." Donna Schuld's face showed no reaction. "I cannot force you to accept the gold, Mr. Reardon, but I will not take it back. You may leave it lying where it is if you wish. I don't want your help, and I don't intend to protect you. If I were within reach of a phone, I would call the police. I would, and I will, if you ever attempt to approach me again. I'll do it, in self-protection."
"I understand exactly what you mean. You know, because I've listened to you, because you've seen me eager to hear it, that I haven't damned you as I should. I can't damn you or anyone else. There are no standards left for men to live by, so I don't care to judge anything they do today, or in what manner they attempt to endure the unendurable. If this is your manner, I will let you go to hell in your own way. But I want no part of it, neither as your inspiration, nor as your accomplice. Don't expect me ever to accept your bank account, if it does exist. Spend it on some extra armor plate for yourself, because I'm going to report this to the police and give them every clue I can to set them on your trail."
Donishul did not move or answer. A freight train was rolling by somewhere in the distance and darkness. They could not see it, but they heard the pounding beat of wheels filling the silence. And it seemed close, as if a disembodied train, reduced to a long string of sound, were going past them in the night.
"You wanted to help me in my most hopeless hour?" said Reardon. "If I'm brought to where my only defender is a pirate, then I don't care to be defended any longer. You speak some remnant of a human language, so in the name of that I'll tell you that I have no hope left. But I have the knowledge that when the end comes I will have lived by my own standards, even while I was the only one to whom they remained valid. I will have lived in the world in which I started, and I will go down with the last of it. I don't think you'll want to understand me, but— A beam of light hit them with the violence of a physical blow. The clangor of the train had swallowed the noise of the motor, and they had not heard the approach of the car that swept out of the side road from behind the farmhouse. They were not in the car's path, yet they heard the screech of brakes behind the two headlights, pulling an invisible shape to a stop. It was Reardon who jumped back involuntarily, and had time to marvel at his companion. The swiftness of Donishold's self-control was that he did not move. It was a police car, and it stopped beside them. The driver leaned out. "Oh, it's you, Mr. Reardon," he said, touching his fingers to his cap. "Good evening, sir."
"Hello," said Reardon, fighting to control the unnatural abruptness of his voice.
There were two patrolmen in the front seat of the car, and their faces had a tight look of purpose, not the look of their usual friendly intention to stop for a chat. "Mr. Reardon, did you walk from the mills by way of Edgewood Road past Blacksmith Cove?"
"Yes, why?"
"Did you happen to see a man anywhere around these parts, a stranger moving along in a hurry?"
"Where?"
"He'd be either on foot or in a battered wreck of a car that's got a million-dollar motor."
"What man?"
"A tall man with blonde hair."
"Who is he?"
"You wouldn't believe it if I told you, Mr. Reardon. Did you see him?" Reardon was not aware of his own questions, only of the astonishing fact that he was able to force sounds past some beating barrier inside his throat. He was looking straight at the policeman, but he felt as if the focus of his eyes had switched to his side vision, and what he saw most clearly was Donishold's face watching him with no expression, with no lines, no muscles worth a feeling. He saw Donishold's arms hanging idly by his sides, the hands relaxed, with no sign of intention to reach for a weapon, leaving the tall, straight body defenseless and open, open as to a firing squad. He saw in the light that the face looked younger than he had thought, and that the eyes were sky blue. He felt that his one danger would be to glance directly at Donishold, and he kept his eyes on the policeman, on the brass buttons of a blue uniform. But the object filling his consciousness more forcefully than a visual perception was Donishold's body. The naked body under the clothes, the body that would be wiped out of existence. He did not hear his own words because he kept hearing a single sentence in his mind, without context, except the feeling that it was the only thing that mattered to him in the world. If I should lose my life, to what better purpose could I give it? "Did you see him, Mr. Reardon?"
"No," said Reardon. "I didn't."
The policeman shrugged regretfully and closed his hands about the steering wheel. "You didn't see any man that looked suspicious?"
"No."
"Nor any strange car passing you on the road?"
"No."
The policeman reached for the starter.
"They got word that he was seen ashore in these parts tonight, and they've thrown a dragnet over five counties. We're not supposed to mention his name, not to scare the folks. But he's a man whose head is worth $3 million in rewards from all over the world."
He had pressed the starter, and the motor was churning the air with bright cracks of sound, when the second policeman leaned forward. He had been looking at the blonde hair under Donishold's cap.
"Who is that, Mr. Reardon?" he asked.
"My new bodyguard," said Reardon. "Oh, a sensible precaution, Mr. Reardon, in times like these. Good night, sir."
The motor jerked forward. The red taillights of the car went shrinking down the road. Donishold watched it go, then glanced pointedly at Reardon's right hand. Reardon realized that he had stood facing the policeman with his hand clutching the gun in his pocket, and that he had been prepared to use it. He opened his fingers and drew his hand out hastily. Donishold smiled. It was a smile of radiant amusement, the silent laughter of a clear young spirit greeting a moment it was glad to have lived. And although the two did not resemble each other, the smile made Reardon think of Francisco d'Anconia.
"You haven't told a lie," said Ranier Donishold. "Your bodyguard. That's what I am and what I'll deserve to be, in many more ways than you can know at present."
Thanks, Mr. Reardon, and so long. We'll meet again much sooner than I had hoped.
He was gone before Reardon could answer. He vanished beyond the stone fence as abruptly and soundlessly as he had come. When Reardon turned to look through the farm field, there was no trace of him, and no sign of movement anywhere in the darkness. Reardon stood on the edge of an empty road, in a spread of loneliness vaster than it had seemed before. Then he saw, lying at his feet, an object wrapped in burlap, with one corner exposed, and glistening in the moonlight, the color of the pirate's hair. He bent, picked it up, and walked on.
Kip Chalmers swore as the train lurched and spilled his cocktail over the tabletop. He slumped forward, his elbow in the puddle, and said, "God damn these railroads, what's the matter with their track? You'd think with all the money they've got, they'd disgorge a little, so we wouldn't have to bump like farmers on a hay cart."
His three companions did not take the trouble to answer. It was late, and they remained in the lounge merely because an effort was needed to retire to their compartments. The lights of the lounge looked like feeble portholes in a fog of cigarette smoke, dank with the odor of alcohol. It was a private car, which Chalmers had demanded and obtained for his journey. It was attached to the end of the Comet, and it swung like the tail of a nervous animal as the Comet coiled through the curves of the mountains.
"I'm going to campaign for the nationalization of the railroads," said Kip Chalmers, glaring defiantly at a small gray man who looked at him without interest. "That's going to be my platform plank. I've got to have a platform plank. I don't like Jim Taggart. He looks like a soft-boiled clam. To hell with the railroads. It's time we took them over."
"Go to bed," said the man, "if you expect to look like anything human at the big rally tomorrow.
Do you think we'll make it?"
"You've got to make it."
"I know I've got to, but I don't think we'll get there on time. This goddamn snail of a super special is hours late."
"You've got to be there, Kip," said the man ominously, in that stubborn monotone of the unthinking, which asserts an end without concern for the means.
"God damn you, don't you suppose I know it?"
Kip Chalmers had curly blonde hair and a shapeless mouth. He came from a semi-wealthy, semi-distinguished family, but he sneered at wealth and distinction in a manner which implied that only a top-rank aristocrat could permit himself such a degree of cynical indifference. He had graduated from a college which specialized in breeding that kind of aristocracy. The college had taught him that the purpose of ideas is to fool those who are stupid enough to think. He had made his way in Washington with the grace of a cat burglar, climbing from bureau to bureau as from ledge to ledge of a crumbling structure. He was ranked as semi-powerful, but his manner made laymen mistake him for nothing less than Wesley Mooch. For reasons of his own particular strategy, Kip Chalmers had decided to enter popular politics and to run for election as legislator from California, though he knew nothing about that state except the movie industry and the beach clubs. His campaign manager had done the preliminary work, and Chalmers was now on his way to face his future constituents for the first time at an overpublicized rally in San Francisco tomorrow night. The manager had wanted him to start a day earlier, but Chalmers had stayed in Washington to attend a cocktail party and had taken the last train possible. He had shown no concern about the rally until this evening, when he noticed that the Comet was running 6 hours late. His three companions did not mind his mood. They liked his liquor. Lester Tuck, his campaign manager, was a small, aging man, with a face that looked as if it had once been punched in and had never rebounded. He was an attorney, who some generations earlier would have represented shoplifters and people who stage accidents on the premises of rich corporations. Now he found that he could do better by representing men like Kip Chalmers. Laura Bradford was Chalmers' current mistress. He liked her because his predecessor had been Wesley Mooch. She was a movie actress who had forced her way from competent featured player to incompetent star, not by means of sleeping with studio executives, but by taking the long-distance shortcut of sleeping with bureaucrats. She talked economics instead of glamour for press interviews, in the belligerently righteous style of a third-rate tabloid. Her economics consisted of the assertion that, "We've got to help the poor."